Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 105.
Picture yourself sitting at the head of this massive, exquisitely carved mahogany table.
Right.
You are hosting the social event of the decade. The room is just radiating with heat from the finest braziers. The air is thick with the scent of like roasted meats, expensive incense, decades-old wine.
Sounds incredible.
Yeah, exactly. All around you are the elite of your city.
Yeah.
You've got politicians, business magnates, old family friends, and just this endless stream of sycophants who desperately need your favor.
Of course.
You are at the absolute apex of your social and political power. Every laugh is a little too loud when you make a joke, you know. Every glass is raised in your direction. Your entire reality is built on this totally unshakable foundation of your family's generational wealth and influence.
Mm-hmm.
And then the music sucks.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. The heavy front doors of your estate don't just open. They are physically breached. Armed government agents flood into your grand hallway, their boots just echoing off the imported marble.
Yeah. The nightmare begins.
Exactly. In a matter of seconds, the laughter dies. The wine sours in your stomach. And you realize that your entire world, everything you believed was permanent and untouchable, is about to be dismantled piece by piece right in front of your eyes.
That scenario you're describing, I mean, it's the ultimate visceral nightmare for anyone who has spent their life insulated by power.
Right.
It's the sudden, catastrophic intrusion of a higher absolute authority, an authority that frankly does not care about your dinner party, your social connections, or your generational wealth.
It just doesn't matter to them.
Exactly. It strips away that invisible armor of status in an instant, leaving the previously untouchable elite completely exposed to the harsh machinery of the state.
And that machinery is exactly what we are dissecting today. We have this amazing stack of source material focused on a text that captures this exact terrifying moment of structural collapse.
It's a really incredible piece of writing.
It is. We are diving deep into chapter 105,
right,
which provides this agonizingly detailed step-by-step account of the imperial raid on the Ningguo and Rongguo mansions, which are the colossal sprawling estates of the immensely powerful Jia family.
Yes.
And reading through these accounts, it doesn't feel like dusty ancient literature. It reads like a modern high-stakes political thriller combined with like the most stressful true crime documentary you've ever seen.
Oh, absolutely. The pacing is relentless.
Yeah. The psychological terror is palpable and the bureaucratic maneuvering is just incredibly sophisticated.
We are going to perform a comprehensive autopsy on a spectacular downfall.
I love that. Mm. An autopsy. To truly understand the shockwave of this event, we have to start at that banquet table.
Mm.
The patriarch, Jia Zhang, is presiding over this massive family gathering. The atmosphere is completely relaxed, bathed in the false security of their elite status, and then the first crack in the foundation appears.
The messenger arrives.
Yes. Servant Lai Da comes sprinting into the main hall, entirely abandoning any sense of decorum, and he is in an absolute state of panic. He announces that an Imperial Guard official named Zhao Quan has arrived at the gates.
And worse, he isn't making a social call.
Right, he is flanked by a contingent of armed officers.
The first mechanism of destruction deployed here isn't physical violence, it's the violent breach of protocol.
Right, because protocol is everything.
Exactly. In this highly stratified aristocratic society, protocol and etiquette are not just manners, they are the structural beams of power. They dictate who has access, who has authority, who controls the social space.
So what's the first rule he breaks?
The absolute most basic rule of this society is the calling card. When an official or a noble arrives at an estate, they present a calling card at the gate. The host then has the agency to accept it, prepare the reception hall, arrange the seating according to rank, and essentially control the psychological battlefield of the meeting.
They set the terms of engagement.
Exactly. And Zhao Quan bypasses all of this. He explicitly refuses to send in his card. He tells the terrified servant, oh, we are close friends. There is no need for that.
Which is just a transparent, almost mocking lie.
A total lie. He then simply strides past the gates and into the heart of the mansion.
That refusal is a massive flashing red siren. I mean, he isn't just skipping a formality. He is executing a calculated psychological strike.
Yes, absolutely.
By walking in unannounced, Zhao Quan is aggressively revoking Jia Zhang's agency in his own home. He is broadcasting loudly and clearly to every servant and guest in that house, your rules, your boundaries, and your social standing no longer apply to me.
My authority supersedes your entire existence.
Exactly.
And that psychological warfare continues the moment Zhao Quan enters the banquet hall. The physical space is immediately disrupted. The guests who a moment ago were lounging and drinking are now terrified.
Right, some are trying to hide behind screens.
Others are standing in awkward, frozen panic. But Zhao Quan doesn't immediately draw a sword or shout orders. He engages in a deeply predatory display. Oh, this part is so creepy.
It really is. He walks right up to Jia Zhang, physically grabs his hand, and starts offering these hollow, grinning pleasantries. He forces Jia Zhang to perform the role of a gracious host while simultaneously knowing he is there to annihilate him.
That specific detail, holding his hand, is incredibly unnerving. It's the physical intimacy of the gesture mixed with the absolute threat of his presence. It completely recontextualizes Zhao Quan from just being a bureaucratic enforcer to someone who is actively savoring the cruelty of the moment.
He is reveling in the terror he is projecting.
He really is.
Yeah.
But just as Zhao Quan is enjoying his power trip, the entire dynamic of the room fractures again because a much higher ranking official arrives on the scene.
Princess Bing.
Yes. And the behavioral contrast between these two men is a masterclass in the different tiers of power.
Prince Xiping operates on a completely different strategic level. When he enters, Zhao Quan immediately snaps to attention. You know, the grinning predator is suddenly subservient.
Right. Zhao Quan demands that the doors of the compound be sealed immediately, wanting to trap everyone inside, guests, servants, family members alike.
You want a total lockdown.
But Prince Xiping, maintaining a calm, almost apologetic demeanor, smiles and overrides him. He looks at the sprawling network of elite guests cowering in the room, and he issues an order to let all the innocent bystanders leave.
Which is wild.
He deliberately allows the Jia family's entire social support network to simply walk out the front door, leaving the targets utterly alone.
I really want to dig into the strategy here, because at first glance, letting people go during a raid seems counterintuitive.
It does, right.
Yeah, if I'm thinking about a modern parallel, Zhao Quan strikes me as the aggressively ambitious mid-level federal prosecutor who just wants to throw the widest net possible. He wants to lock down the entire building, seize everyone's phones, subpoena the interns.
Create maximum collateral chaos because it looks great on his record.
Exactly. While Prince Xiping, on the other hand, is the seasoned operator. He knows that if you execute a raid and inadvertently lock up half the board of directors of other major companies who just happen to be at the party, you are going to trigger a massive, uncontrolled backlash.
The political ecosystem of the imperial capital relies on fragile alliances and a balance of power. Prince Xiping understands this ecosystem perfectly. These guests are not nobodies.
Right. They are the upper crust of the aristocracy.
They have their own powerful relatives, their own favors to call in, and their own private armies of influence. If you lock them in with the Jia family, you accidentally merge their interests.
Oh, wow. I mean, think of that.
Yeah, you give the Jia family instant, powerful allies who are forced to fight back against the raid just to save themselves. By letting them go, Prince Xiping acts with surgical precision.
He severs the Jia family from their network.
He turns a potential political firestorm into an isolated, controlled demolition.
Think about the brutal reality of that moment for the Jia family. For you listening, your social status is the currency of your life. And in the span of maybe 3 minutes, an imperial official tells your dearest friends, your business partners, the people who were just toasting to your health,
that they're free to leave.
And they don't hesitate. They don't stay to defend you. They sprint for the exits. It's a blur of panicked silk and dropping wine glasses as they trip over themselves to avoid the radioactive fallout of your downfall. It completely exposes the transactional, hollow nature of their entire social universe.
The evaporation of that social capital is absolute. It reinforces a terrifying truth about power, which is that influence only exists as long as the state permits it. The moment the umbrella of imperial favor is retracted, the entire illusion of friendship and loyalty dissolves. The Jia family is left standing in the ruins of their own banquet, surrounded only by empty chairs and the armed guards who are about to read their fate.
Which brings us to the actual bureaucratic mechanics of their ruin. The audience is gone, the doors are finally sealed, and now the family has to face the paper that authorizes this nightmare. Prince Xiping unrolls the imperial decree.
The reading of the decree initiates the formal legal destruction of the family. The decree specifically targets Jia Shi, who is Jia Zhang's older brother.
Okay.
The charges read aloud are devastating and comprehensive. She is formally stripped of his hereditary title, which is the very foundation of his identity and privilege.
The thing that makes him who he is.
Exactly. He is charged with colluding with outside officials, aggressively abusing his power, bullying the weak and common people, and fundamentally disgracing his ancestors.
Wow.
In a society built on filial piety and ancestral honor, that last charge is an ideological death sentence as much as a legal one.
And Zhao Quan, slipping right back into his role as the attack dog, immediately demands that Jia Shi be arrested, shackled, and hauled away. But he doesn't stop there, right?
No, he demands that the guards begin a comprehensive ransacking of the entire sprawling estate. Every courtyard, every locked chest, every private room.
But here again, Prince Siping steps in as the voice of restraint, attempting to limit the blast radius.
Prince Siping tries to enforce a strict, literal interpretation of the decree. He points out a very important geographic and structural reality of the estate. While they all live within the same massive compound walls, Jia Shi and his brother Jia Zeng operate separate households.
They have different courtyards, different staff, different daily lives.
Because the emperor's decree explicitly names Jia Shi, Prince Siping argues that the search and seizure must be legally contained strictly to Jia Shi's side of the property. He is trying to protect the presumed innocent branch of the family.
But Zhao Quan is armed with a terrifying legal loophole, and he deploys it immediately. Here's where it gets really interesting. He counters Prince Siping by bringing up the concept of undivided family assets.
Yes, the undivided family.
He points out that technically, on official government paper, the Jia family has never formally legally divided their generational wealth.
Mm.
And to make matters infinitely worse, Jia Shi's son, Jia Lian, is currently serving as the general manager for the entire estate, including Jia Zhang's supposedly separate household.
Right.
Therefore, as Zhao Quan argues, there is no legal firewall.
What?
It's all one giant contaminated pool of assets, and everything is subject to seizure.
This is a phenomenal example of how the state weaponizes tradition against its citizens. The concept of undivided family assets stems from deep Confucian ideals. It is meant to enforce family unity, to ensure that brothers support one another, and to honor the patriarch by keeping his legacy whole.
It is supposed to be a moral shield.
But Zhao Quan ruthlessly flips it into a sword. Because the family adhered to this tradition of communal wealth, and because they used a centralized manager in Jia Lian to run the logistics, the guilt of one individual instantly infects the entire structure. The legal separation that Prince Siping tried to argue simply does not exist on paper.
Let's contextualize how terrifying that legal trap is for you as a listener. Imagine you are living a clean, completely law-abiding life. But 20 years ago, you co-signed a mortgage with your brother, or you kept your name on a joint family trust because it was the tradition.
Very common.
Your brother lives in another state, and unbeknownst to you, he begins running a massive criminal syndicate. When the federal government finally brings the hammer down and freezes his assets, your bank accounts, your retirement fund, the deed to your house, everything you own, is instantly frozen and seized because your name is attached to that joint entity.
Everything is gone.
You are suddenly drowning in a criminal current you didn't even know existed, simply because of a structural technicality.
That analogy perfectly captures the sheer panic of Jia Zeng in this moment. And Zhao Quan's aggressive interpretation of the law immediately bears terrifying fruit.
It gets worse.
Much worse. As the guards are unleashed to tear through the entire estate, shattering the physical boundaries of the household, they uncover items that instantly escalate the situation from corruption to potential annihilation. They find what the text refers to as prohibited items. Specifically, they find hidden caches of imperial clothing.
Now, we really need to pause and explain this because to a modern ear, finding prohibited clothing sounds like getting a fine for bringing counterfeit bags through customs. It sounds like a fashion violation.
It does sound minor to us.
But in the context of the imperial dynasty, what does the possession of these items actually mean?
It is the difference between a prison sentence and the systematic execution of your entire bloodline.
Wow.
Sumptuary laws in imperial China were incredibly strict and meticulously detailed. The emperor held a monopoly not just on political power, but on specific aesthetics.
Like colors and fabrics.
Exactly. Certain colors, like specific shades of yellow, certain fabrics, and highly specific motifs, most notably the five-clawed dragon, were legally reserved solely for the emperor's physical body and immediate use.
So no one else could wear them?
No one. To possess these items in your private home is not a mistake. It is viewed by the state as an act of treason.
Treason?
It implies that you are either preparing to usurp the throne, outfitting a private imperial court, or at the very least believing yourself to be equal to the Son of Heaven. It triggers the ultimate paranoia of the state, and the standard punishment is death, often extending to multiple generations of the family to eradicate the treasonous root.
It is genuinely hard to overstate the psychological horror of that discovery. They are already facing ruin for corruption, and suddenly a guard pulls a yellow silk robe out of a trunk and the heir just leaves the room. Because that piece of fabric represents the executioner's blade for every man, woman, and child in the compound.
Yep, it's a death sentence.
And as if the treasonous clothing wasn't enough, the guards also uncover a mountain of documents proving widespread usury, which is the systemic issuing of illegal high-interest loans. They are caught with the physical evidence of treason and the paper trail of predatory financial exploitation. The situation is completely, utterly hopeless.
The trap has fully sprung. But just as Zhao Quan is likely calculating his own massive promotion for uncovering this treason, the political machinery of the capital grinds gears again. A second imperial heavy hitter arrives.
Prince Beijing.
And he doesn't just arrive to observe. He brings a second freshly issued imperial decree.
Another piece of paper.
And this new order fundamentally alters the trajectory of the raid. It commands Zhao Quan to take the primary target, Jia Shi, away for interrogation, and then explicitly dismisses Zhao Quan from the premises.
He fires him from the raid.
Prince Xibing is left in absolute control of the operation, effectively neutralizing Zhao Quan's campaign of total, unmitigated destruction.
Is it just me, or is the timing of this incredibly suspicious? Zhao Quan is minutes away from burning the whole family tree down, and suddenly another prince walks in with a piece of paper that effectively tells the attack dog to go wait in the car. Is this just dumb luck, or are we watching a shadow war play out in real time?
We are absolutely watching a shadow war. Imperial politics rarely rely on coincidence. The sudden arrival of Prince Beijing with a counter-decree suggests massive, invisible forces moving behind the scenes.
Like allies.
It is highly probable that the Jia family's remaining political allies in the capital, upon hearing the raid had begun, immediately mobilized to petition the emperor or leverage rival factions in the court. Alternatively, the emperor himself may have recognized that allowing a blunt instrument like Zhao Quan to completely obliterate a deeply connected aristocratic family would upset the balance of power too drastically.
Ah, so it's a calibration.
Prince Beijing represents a real-time calibration of imperial justice. They want to punish the family, yes, but they do not want a massacre.
And the princes make that calibration incredibly obvious in how they handle the literal treason they just found. When they are presented with the prohibited imperial clothing, they don't immediately call for the executioner.
Precisely. They engage in a calculated piece of political theater. Instead of formally logging the items as treasonous contraband, the princes look at the incredibly dangerous clothing and helpfully offer an alternative narrative.
Which is?
They suggest out loud, these items must have been prepared by the family for the imperial concubine.
Because a female member of the Jia family serves as a concubine to the emperor.
Right. It provides a razor-thin, yet technically plausible, legal fiction. They are intentionally creating a loophole to defuse the most lethal charge on the table. It is a massive, life-saving political favor, signaling that the state wants to financially ruin them, not physically slaughter them.
It's fascinating how malleable the absolute law of the emperor becomes when high-level politicians decide it needs to be.
Truly.
So while these immensely powerful men are standing in the grand reception halls, engaging in this high-stakes chess match over decrees, joint assets, and the legal definition of a silk robe, I want to completely shift our perspective.
Let's do it.
Because while the front of the house is experiencing a tense, cerebral, bureaucratic dismantling, the back of the house, the inner quarters, is experiencing absolute, visceral, physical terror.
The contrast between the two spaces is perhaps the most striking element of this entire narrative. In the front halls, men are arguing about jurisdiction and legal technicalities. But in the inner quarters, the raid manifests as pure, unadulterated violence.
It's a completely different experience.
The spatial segregation of ancient Chinese estates meant that the inner quarters were entirely the domain of the women. It was a secluded, heavily protected sanctuary. To have that boundary breached by strange armed men is not just frightening, it is a fundamental collapse of their entire reality.
Right now, deep in the estate, Grandmother Jia, the revered matriarch, and the women of the household are having their own separate banquet. Wang Shifeng, a brilliant central figure who is formerly the iron-fisted manager of the entire state's finances, is there, though she is currently very ill.
They are completely insulated from the political chess match happening out front.
And suddenly, the illusion of safety shatters. Servants from another courtyard rush into the room, completely hysterical. They are stammering, unable to form coherent sentences, screaming that robbers wearing boots and hats are violently ransacking the cabinets and smashing the storage boxes.
Pay close attention to the vocabulary those servants use. They don't shout that imperial guards are executing a decree. They scream about robbers.
Because they have no idea.
The women have not been read a warrant. They have not been briefed on the political factions of Prince Xiping versus Zhao Quan. From their perspective, their impregnable fortress has been suddenly and inexplicably invaded by violent marauders. The sudden appearance of men in boots-heavy, outdoor footwear, strictly forbidden in the pristine inner sanctums, is a profound visual shock that signals the complete desecration of their safe space.
A maid named Pinger comes sprinting into the room, her clothes torn and her hair completely disheveled. And she reports that these armed men are physically dragging everyone out of their private rooms. They were throwing people into the courtyards to seize the property. The psychological impact of this sudden violence is immediate and physically devastating.
Yes.
Wang Shifeng, who is already weakened by illness, simply collapses. The text describes her as looking literally dead from the sheer shock of the moment. And Grandmother Jia, the undisputed ruler of this inner world, is completely paralyzed, reduced to uncontrollable sobbing.
Wang Shifeng's physical collapse is deeply symbolic, but it is also grounded in acute psychological trauma. Remember her role. She was the architect of the family's daily financial reality. She knew the contents of every ledger, the location of every chest of silver, the intricate balance of the household's wealth.
So seeing it destroyed is destroying her.
To sit there and watch strange men violently tear apart her ledgers, smash her cabinets, and physically dismantle the very structure of her power and identity, it breaks her mind and her body simultaneously. Her physical collapse is the literal manifestation of the household's economic collapse.
It is the ancient equivalent of a violent, no-knock SWAT raid on your private home.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the sheer, terrifying whiplash. You are sitting with your grandmother, sipping tea, surrounded by walls that have kept your family safe for generations. And 3 minutes later, armed men are kicking your bedroom door off the hinges, dragging you out by your arms, and throwing your most intimate private belongings onto the dirt of the courtyard. The violation is absolute.
And amidst this deafening chaos, Jia Lian, who is Wang Shifeng's husband, and the man whose name is on the legal paperwork causing this disaster, rushes into the women's quarters. He is in a state of absolute frantic panic.
He runs into the room and is confronted with a nightmare.
He sees his brilliant wife lying on the floor, seemingly dead. He sees his powerful grandmother collapsing in a heap of grief. And in his mind, he knows the lethal legal trap that Zhao Quan is currently springing in the front hall.
And in the middle of this sensory overload, Jia Lian makes a choice that is deeply fascinating. He drops to his knees next to Grandmother Jia, and he lies to her.
He lies to her.
He tells her that his father, Jia Shi, the primary target of the entire raid, has simply been taken away for questioning. He softens the blow. He deliberately hides the scope of the raid, the treason charges, the total asset seizure, and the utter ruin of the family. Why does Jia Lian choose to construct this lie when the reality of the destruction is literally happening in the next room?
Jia Lian is executing an impossible act of psychological triage. He is a man caught in the epicenter of a multi-front war. He is managing the bureaucratic execution of his family's wealth, the physical arrest of his father, the apparent death of his wife, and the very real possibility that his grandmother, the emotional and spiritual anchor of the entire dynasty, is about to suffer a fatal shock.
He's trying to keep her alive.
He lies because he desperately needs to keep the matriarch alive. He is trying to construct a temporary, fragile buffer against reality, even as the walls of that reality are being physically torn down around them. It is a moment that exposes the crushing, impossible burden of crisis management falling entirely onto his shoulders in a matter of seconds.
It is a heartbreaking display of a man trying to hold back a tsunami with his bare hands. Eventually, the women are displaced, locked away in cold, empty rooms with absolutely nothing but the clothes on their backs. The physical invasion concludes, the guards finish tearing the estate down to the studs, and that brings us to the agonizing aftermath, the inventory.
The meticulous accounting of exactly what was dragged out into the daylight.
Yes.
This sequence is critical. Jilin is forced to stand in the courtyard and watch silently as the imperial accountants methodically tally his family's confiscated lifeblood. And the inventory list provided in the text isn't just a ledger, it is a staggering, overwhelming monument to their hoarded wealth.
I'm going to read off some of these numbers because hearing the sheer volume is the only way to comprehend the scale of their privilege.
Go for it.
They dragged out 123 pieces of solid gold jewelry, 13 massive strings of flawless pearls, 40 solid gold spoons,
40 cool.
80 large silver bowls. And then you get to the textiles and the furs, and it stops sounding like a household and starts sounding like an imperial warehouse.
Oh, the furs are unbelievable.
18 black fox pelts, 36 mink skins, 12 lynx, 160 gray squirrel pelts, 6 full tiger skins.
6 tiger skins.
16 sea dragon skins. 130 intact rolls of pure, untouched silk, alongside hundreds upon hundreds of fully tailored garments. And then the liquid assets. 5,200 taels of damp silver, 50 taels of gold, and 7,000 massive strings of copper cash.
To analyze this inventory is to analyze the pathology of aristocratic excess. This list is a deliberate, pointed indictment to the author. When you look at the specifics, the 40 gold spoons, the tiger skins, the impossibly rare sea dragon pelts, these are not items required for even the most luxurious daily living.
They don't need these to survive.
No. This represents an obsessive, systemic hoarding of wealth far beyond any conceivable practical need. They are accumulating resources purely for the sake of accumulation, stripping wealth from the outside world and burying it within their walls. And the most damning detail of all is the specific description of the damp silver.
Yes, I really wanted to drill down on that. Out of all the adjectives you could use to describe a fortune, why explicitly mention that the 5,200 taels of silver are damp?
It is a brilliant, subtle piece of economic storytelling. Silver becomes damp when it has been sealed away in deep subterranean cellars or buried in hidden vaults for decades.
Oh, wow.
It implies that this massive fortune hasn't seen the light of day, let alone been circulated in the local economy, for a very long time. It has gathered moisture from the earth itself. It is dead wealth.
Dead wealth. That is such a powerful image.
While commoners outside their walls are starving, struggling to pay taxes, and being crushed by debt, this family has thousands of taels of silver literally rotting in the dark. It is a powerful condemnation of their parasitic relationship with the broader society.
Listening to that inventory read aloud, I can't help but draw a line to how we experience these events today. It is exactly like watching a federal task force raid the compound of a corrupt billionaire or a cartel boss. You watch the news anchors methodically list off the seized assets, the fleet of luxury helicopters, the solid gold bathroom fixtures, the millions in bundled cash hidden in the walls.
It's the same feeling.
And the sheer absurd volume of the luxury goods becomes almost sickening when you juxtapose it against the reality that this family is now legally and morally obliterated. All those tiger skins and gold spoons couldn't buy them an ounce of protection when the system finally turned on them. The stuff was ultimately useless.
Exactly. The physical wealth is confiscated, but it is the paperwork found alongside it that seals their legal doom. As the inventory is completed, the princes turn their attention to Jia Zhang, and they confront him with the usury documents, the detailed ledgers of high-interest loans that the guards found specifically hidden in Jia Lian's private rooms.
Jia Zhang, the patriarch, immediately throws his hands up and claims total ignorance. He swears to the princes that he had absolutely no idea the shadow bank was operating inside his own home.
And the princes make the severity of the situation incredibly clear. They explain that while they were willing to use political maneuvering to excuse the treasonous imperial clothing, they cannot and will not ignore the usury.
So they draw the line there.
Yes. In this society, issuing high-interest loans was not just illegal, it was considered deeply, fundamentally immoral. It was the ultimate proof of exploiting the vulnerable. It proves that the family wasn't just passively hoarding wealth in the dark. They were actively, aggressively bleeding the common people dry to maintain their lavish lifestyle. The ledgers are tangible proof of systemic predation.
So Jia Zhang is backed into a corner, facing the reality of these predatory loans. And in that moment, Jia Lian steps up. He drops to his knees on the stone courtyard right in front of the princes, and he claims absolute sole responsibility for the entire usury operation.
A huge moment.
He begs the princes to believe that his uncle, Jia Zhang, was entirely innocent and ignorant of the scheme. Because of this confession, Jia Lian is immediately placed in chains and taken into imperial custody.
Jia Lian's confession is a moment of profound, calculated sacrifice, designed to ensure the biological and social survival of the family line. It is a strategic move on the chessboard of their ruin.
How so?
By taking the full weight of the usury charges, he effectively builds a legal firewall around Jia Xing. Consider the board at this moment. Jia Xing has already been hauled away for corruption and abuse of power. If Jia Xing is taken down for usury, the entire upper echelon of the family is eradicated.
There's no one left to lead.
There would be no high-ranking male left with the freedom, the political rank, or the social capital to advocate for the family, to protect the vulnerable women, or to manage the catastrophic fallout. Jia Lian realizes, with brutal clarity, that the pristine patriarch must survive if the family is to have any hope of a future.
That strategy makes total sense from a survival standpoint. But I have to push back on the morality of it. Does Jia Lian actually deserve to take the solitary fall here? Or is he just the designated convenient scapegoat for a corrupt system that the entire family happily fed off of?
It's a great question.
Because let's be real, the usury ledgers were found in his room. He was the manager. He was undoubtedly the one executing these illegal loans, sending out the enforcers and collecting the silver. But Jia Zeng was sitting at that banquet table, eating delicacies with those 40 solid gold spoons, entirely funded by that exact same dirty money.
It is a brilliant tension in the text. Jia Lian is absolutely a scapegoat, but he is a fully guilty scapegoat. He executed the crimes, he built the shadow bank, but he did it specifically to generate the massive cash flow required to maintain the extravagant, glittering lifestyle that the innocent Jia Zeng enjoyed while keeping his own hands meticulously clean.
Wow. Plausible deniability.
Jia Zeng possessed the ultimate luxury of the elite, the luxury of plausible deniability. He could remain pure because Jia Lian was willing to do the dirty work in the shadows. The entire structure of the dynasty required both components to function, the morally pristine figurehead and the ruthless, corrupt operator pulling the levers.
That is such a dark, cynical, and ultimately true reality of how systemic wealth operates. So we've witnessed the physical raid. We've seen the staggering hoard of wealth hauled out into the courtyard and itemized. We know what they lost. But now we have to pivot to the final, most crucial piece of the puzzle.
The why.
Yes, the why. While the raid was technically triggered by a specific decree against Jia Xi, the intelligence bleeding in from the outside world begins to reveal the horrifying truth of exactly why this dynasty fell.
The imperial raid was simply the sudden physical manifestation of their downfall, but the structural decay, the deep moral rot, had been hollowing out the family from the inside for years.
Exactly. While the raid is concluding, Jia Zhang is pacing in the courtyards, completely shell-shocked, and he encounters an incredibly poignant figure, an ancient servant named Jiao Da.
Yes, Jiao Da.
Jiao Da isn't just staff, he is 80 or 90 years old. He has been with the Jia family since its absolute inception. And right now, he is in the middle of a suicidal, agonizing breakdown. He is wailing at the top of his lungs, screaming about how he literally bled on battlefields to build the glory of the ancestors, only to watch the worthless, degenerate younger generation squander it all.
A powerful scene.
And in his screaming, he drops a massive piece of intelligence. He reveals that Jia Zhen and Jia Rong, the leaders of the adjacent Eastern Mansion, have already been arrested and dragged away by a completely different imperial prince. The purge is wider than they thought.
Jiao Da is arguably the most important thematic figure in this entire sequence. He serves as the screaming moral conscience of the narrative. He is the physical embodiment, the living memory of how this immense wealth and status was originally acquired. It wasn't handed to them. It was earned through actual blood, sweat, unshakable loyalty, and genuine dangerous service to the empire.
So he's looking at the contrast.
His raw, agonizing grief highlights the sickening contrast between the noble, self-sacrificing foundation built by the ancestors and the corrupt, parasitic, arrogant behavior of the current generation. He is quite literally the ghost of their past, standing in the courtyard screaming at the nightmare of their present.
And Jiao Da's hysterical screams are immediately validated by hard, terrifying intelligence. A younger relative, Xu Ge, manages to sneak into the locked compound by bribing the guards at the perimeter. He finds Jia Zhang and delivers the devastating news of what the outside world is saying. This is the moment the veil is fully ripped away and we see the true, horrifying scope of the family's crimes.
This intelligence briefing is the moment we realize that this wasn't just a political misstep or a minor factional dispute at court. The family wasn't brought down by a misunderstanding. They were brought down by a long, documented history of deep, systemic moral rot.
Zige reports the details of the impeachments. He says that the imperial censors targeted Jia Xin not just for standard financial corruption, but for running illegal gambling rings, specifically designed to lure in and trap other noble youths.
Which is bad enough.
But that is just the beginning. Horrifyingly, the censors also charged the family with forcibly taking a civilian woman as a concubine and subjecting her to such severe abuse that she was driven to suicide. And the victim's family, the Zhangs, actually managed to bring a massive lawsuit against them. Furthermore, the original target, Jia Xi, is revealed to have been impeached for aggressively meddling in local lawsuits and violently abusing commoners in a region called Pingyin Prefecture.
We need to unpack the mechanisms of these charges, starting with the censors. The censorate in imperial China was a terrifying institution. They were essentially the internal affairs division of the empire, operating independently of the standard bureaucratic chain of command and reporting directly to the emperor.
Oh, so they had total oversight.
Their sole job was to root out corruption and moral decay among the elite. When a censor formally moves against you, it means the protective bubble of your aristocratic rank has already been pierced by the emperor's suspicion.
And the specific nature of these crimes, running gambling rings, driving a civilian woman to her death, it paints a picture of a family entirely out of control.
Exactly. Look at the progression of the rot. Running predatory gambling rings that target other nobles demonstrates a complete decay of loyalty to their own class. But the charges regarding the civilian woman and the abuses in Pingyin Prefecture are far more damning.
Because it shows how they treated the vulnerable.
They demonstrate a family that genuinely believed their aristocratic status granted them a divine immunity from the law. They operated under the delusion that they were gods among mortals, entitled to consume the lives, bodies, and resources of the common people without any fear of consequence or reprisal. They believed they were untouchable.
And that profound arrogance is exactly why their current isolation is so absolute.
Yeah.
Shuke finishes his report by telling Jia Zhang the most bitter truth of all. Their entire social network has vanished. All the former friends, the political allies, the endless stream of relatives who used to beg at their gates for favors and money, they are all actively avoiding the family. Some are even standing in the streets, openly gloating and celebrating their downfall.
It is the final brutal realization of how power operates. The respect, the deference, the thousands of toasts at their banquets, none of it was ever for who they were as people. It was entirely for the power they wielded. The relationships were purely transactional.
So the second the power is gone.
The exact second they lose the power to dispense rewards or inflict punishments, they're instantly discarded. The social ecosystem expels them, abandoning them to the wolves of the state without a second thought.